I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
On the Empire podcast this week, we talked The Last Showgirl with Pamela Anderson and Mickey 17 with that film star Naomi Aki. And don't let the fact that we haven't seen the previous 16 Mickeys get in the way. All that plus usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that picks its feet in Poughkeepsie. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Emperor podcast. How are we all? How are you? How are the kids? Great. Excellent. Enough small talk. I'm joined this week by my 3 colleagues of such lethal cunning. Geek Queen Helen O'Hara is here. Hello.
Hello.
Sorry. I got it completely wrong. Geek Queen Helen Skywalker is here. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I just saw Much Ado About Nothing on stage last night, so I'm all the better for it.
And this is good, right?
Unlike really good.
The Tempest from the same director, Jamie Lloyd. This is avoided the curse of Jamie Lloyd.
Yeah.
It actually has colour in it and fun.
Because it has Tom Hiddleston and Hayley Atwell, who are both colourful and fun. And there is lots of pink confetti and a giant pink heart.
Oh,
but I would
such an easy sell.
I would like Jamie Lloyd to branch out a bit and consider, I don't know, backdrops, sets. Like, did a backdrop fall on his parents and kill them? Like, what's
maybe,
the backstory?
Maybe yes.
There? Maybe yes.
Maybe yeah.
But
maybe,
you know,
he's working through something.
Maybe one of them stole his girlfriend once, and now
backdrop.
He has a grudge against backdrops. But like,
backdrop
I would
stole
really,
my girlfriend.
I would really like some sets. That would be cool.
I would also like some. Oh, sets. Sorry,
sets. Yes,
yes, with a T.
Here's Hayley Atwell was good.
Yes, Hayley Atwell was excellent.
Well, that Atwell.
James Dyer. Oh, hello.
Here's a man who is sets deprived and doesn't wait to be introduced on the podcast. He is a force of nature. And by force of nature, I mean, of course, the dreadful Ben Affleck, Sandra Bullock movie. It's James Dyer. I know it's forces of nature, but what could you do? I had to work with something at short notice. I amended the title to my own devious ends. Hello, Jimbo. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Chris. I am good.
Excellent.
I have not seen any Shakespeare. I regret to inform you.
Ever?
I mean, I've seen Shakespeare in the past. I mean, we're not friends or anything, but
you killed 5 actors, good ones.
No, but I've not been to see any of the theatre.
We're joined for the first time in a long while. Actually, I can't remember the last
time
that Alex Godfrey managed to circumvent our security procedures and get into the recording booth. But here he is. Hello, Alex.
It's a very nice way of saying that you have not asked me to come onto the podcast for a long time.
There's a standing invitation.
Is there?
There's always an open invitation.
I was not made aware of this.
You know, I want you on a podcast, as evidenced by yesterday when I went, who wants to be on the podcast this week? And you went...
No, and I said, may I?
And you said, yes, I'm available.
Yeah. And you said, okay.
Oh, for the love of God. Alex, have you seen a Shakespeare?
Not of late, but yes. Quite a few. I went to see Midsummer Night Dream.
At the Bridge?
No, in Regent's
Park. Under the Bridge?
Open Air Theatre with my parents many decades ago, with Bernard Breslaw as Bottom, I believe.
Oh my God.
When I was doing English literature for my A-level, there was a class trip to go and see Antony and Cleopatra.
Hang on, Bernard Breslaw?
Yes.
From the Carry On movies.
Yes. It wasn't in the Carry On movies, and he did work after the Carry On movies as well.
Oh my God.
It was exciting.
Sorry, I'm being Breslawist here.
what is the surprise to you?
I didn't think that he would be a good Bottom.
More of a top.
Oh, come on, guys. Let's not drag this podcast down to my level, please.
He was a fun Bottom. Why would you not think so?
I've always thought he was too burly to be. I haven't always thought. I literally just formed his opinion in the last 30 seconds. But to me, he would have been too burly to be a Bottom. I think Bottom is Because recently, Matthew Bainton from Ghosts and Horrible Histories and Yonderland, he played Bottom. And for me, that is who Bottom should be. Bottom should be.
Bernard Breslau is a big, is what you're saying.
But he looks more of a Puck, like, looks-wise.
Maybe he wasn't Bottom. Maybe he was Puck. I'm pretty sure he's Bottom because...
I think he was Bottom.
Because
he had the ears on the thing.
Bernard Breslau is a big Bottom. Big Bottom. Talk about bum cakes. My girl's got him.
Oh, no.
You've made me doubt myself, so I've looked it up. He actually played Bottom in 1980. And then again, which is when I would have gone, 18th of June... September 1986.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
Midsummer Night's Dream, Regent's Park.
That's a long time.
Yes. And I remember it well because, you know, I loved the Carry On films and he was funny.
Mm. Star of Crow.
I saw Hamid Animashon do it. Well, he's the guy from The Festival. He was so good in The Festival.
Okay.
You've seen him in, he's in Wheel of Time, obviously, My Beloved Wheel of Time.
Yeah. Does he play Alan?
no, he doesn't. but he was an absolutely fantastic Bottom, and he fell in love with, they did a bit of a gender swap between Titania and Oberon in that one, at the bridge.
Helen is handing me her phone, and on it is a picture of a Bottom. And yes, indeed.
That's usually to be found there.
That is a fine Bottom, Helen.
Anyway, that bridge production is coming back, by the way. People should go. It was incredible. That was one with Gwendolyn Christie as well, was Titania. Amazing.
Oh. Do you think when Shakespeare got someone else to write A Midsummer Night's Dream for him all those years ago?
He would have
conceived of this that over 400 years later, people would have been giggling about the word bottom on a podcast.
Do you not think people will be listening to this podcast in 400 years?
No. I'm not sure we're making it out the next 4 years. Never mind the next 400. But anyway, that wasn't the question. The question wasn't about Bottoms. But maybe it should be. Maybe next week's Mount Rushmore should be great movie Bottoms.
Yes.
And we should just have four arses on Mount Rushmore.
It's a bit, isn't that a bit Idiocracy? Wasn't that, do you remember the film in Idiocracy, which was just a still shot of a bottom farting occasionally? And that was like the box office hit of the future.
I like this question and I cannot lie.
that is amazing. All right, so this week's question is going to be a Mount Rushmore, folks.
Oh, boy.
Woohoo!
So I'm going to pull the curtain back slightly. I wanted this week's question to be about the best movie Monkees, inspired by The Monkey, which came out last week, of course, in cinemas. And I basically have gone on Threads because I said this week's question would come from Threads.
Sure.
And I've asked people to ask me that question on Threads.
Oh, my God.
So I've gamed the system.
Not so much gamed as like full on cheated, I would say, but sure.
All right. Well, here we go. Here we go. The first person to say to me who were the greatest movie monkeys or apes on Threads was Douglas Hahner. Colin McKinney tried to be clever and say Mount Rushmore of iconic simians in film.
Ooh, using different words.
Yeah, he gets thesaurus points for that. Follow the Lemur said, who are the most King of Kongs? JLW Root said, what are the greatest or scariest on-screen monkeys? Lawant says, do you have a hypothesis why 2024 was so obsessed with monkeys? Glasgow Paul said, would coked up Robbie Williams be able to beat the gibbon in Gladiator 2? Neil Briscoe says, dear Chris, should I hate every ape I see from chimpanzee to chimpanzee?
Never make a monkey out of me.
To the best monkeys, Mount Rushmore.
Are you okay?
Mount Rushmore. Mount Rushmore. That's where we've landed, right?
Yes, but yes.
So it's like the ending of Planet of the Apes.
But it's not.
But unfortunately, it's like the Tim Burton one, and so we're trying to carve some monkeys.
But we've used up four spaces on Mount Rushmore because clearly it's Mickey Dolenz, Davy Jones, Peter Tork, and the other one. So, you know.
He's so clever. He's look at him. He's beaming.
Hey,
he's beaming away.
Yeah. Like a little cheeky monkey.
He's a believer.
That's
look
right.
at him.
Lovely.
Yeah. No. Can you justify legitimately? Have you seen Head?
I beg your pardon?
The Monkees movie.
Do you know what? I actually have, though I remember almost nothing about it, but I used to watch the show quite regularly.
Okay, well, Head is completely weird and fucked up. But can you legitimately look me in the eye and say
no.
No, okay.
Under no circumstances.
Wow.
Although there were some formidable haircuts.
You're going to really stand up to enhanced interrogation yeah, with that.
That's it. No, that's it. I'll tell you anything.
He folds under questioning. I love the Monkees. I think they're terrific. I'm a big fan of the Porpoise song in particular. I'm sure Alex knows the Monkees intimately.
Yeah. I grew up watching the Monkees. I love the Monkees.
With Bernard Breslau. He took you by the hand.
Will you leave Bernard Breslau out of it? Yeah, I love them. But Head is a really, really, really strange film. I mean, it's not like a feature adaptation of a Monkees episode. It's the late 60s.
Psychedelia.
Yeah. Mm. Jack Nicholson was involved.
Bob Raffleson, directed it, didn't he?
Jack Nicholson in it?
I think Nicholson might be in it, or he was certainly very, very high when he was watching it. One of the two.
Yeah. It's a weird film. It's a difficult film.
It
was very of its time.
I don't think we're putting Dolan's Nesmith Jones or Nesmith.
The other one.
No one's ever pronounced his name like that. Or Torque.
Yeah.
On the Mount Rushmore of movie Monkees. I'll give you a few minutes to Google.
Oh my goodness.
Alex.
Hello.
Do you have a movie Monkey you would like to put on the Mount Rushmore?
I have a few. The first one that came to mind.
Monkees, I had a few, as Frank Sinatra famously said.
Bernard Breslau did a great cover of it. The first one that came to mind was Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, Nazi Monkey.
The only good Nazi Monkey is a dead Nazi Monkey.
Fair.
And that Nazi Monkey gets fucked up.
Mm. Well, that's true, although I've had worse dates.
That was very good, James. Well done. The next one I thought of was the monkey that loses its shit in...
I thought you were going to say virginity.
Like, I would have said that? Yeah, the monkey that loses its virginity.
Why?
Curious George.
No.
Very curious George.
No.
Curious Gorge.
Come on.
What is happening?
The monkey that loses its shit.
Yes.
Okay.
In Nope.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, we should, for the sake of Terry Pratchett's librarian, say, for the purposes of this question, we are expanding the term monkey to also include apes, which are technically not. Yeah.
Well, of course we're including apes, because without that, we can't say Clyde from Every Which Way But Loose or Any Which Way You Can.
I know,
that's true.
I know that was your focus.
It's the only reason I did this question.
Wow.
So the monkey loses his shit. So far you've gone for a Nazi monkey.
You've got a Nazi monkey.
And a killer monkey.
And a murderous, like a spree killer monkey. Those are your monkeys that you want to put on Mount Rushmore.
Well, hang on. I think saying that, like, these are the most iconic movie monkeys and saying I want to see them that rendered in real life as a presidential monument is not quite the same thing. But unless I'm misunderstanding the rules and you're being completely literal about it.
No, I'm not being completely. I will accept monkeys of any size, of any shape, of any color. They can be animated. They cannot be. They can be even not real or like an object, like the monkey from The Monkey, which is not a real monkey. It's a toy monkey.
Right.
Right. I have two animated monkeys.
Where?
No, on my list of monkeys to nominate.
Okay, let's go for it.
Okay, the first one is Monkey, as in voiced by Charlize Theron in Kubo and the Two Strings.
Ah.
Right, good monkey.
Good monkey. Mm. Cool monkey, like kind of threatening monkey at times.
All right.
But also like a formidable monkey, but also like ultimately a good monkey.
I can't say I'm familiar with that monkey's work.
It's a very good film that you really should watch. Is a bit of a metaphor, but also it's a monkey. So
okay.
It's got that going for it. And my second monkey is Steve from Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs too. Steve
that's
is great
strong.
Because
that
so
is
Steve
strong.
Has a monkey thought translator, but basically all that Steve says is Steve. It is also the name of my brother's robot vacuum. It is named after the monkey in Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and I just have a lot of affection for Steve.
Steve is naturally it would be a Steve for you, wouldn't it? You've gone straight to a Steve.
I'm just glad because when you said I've got two animated monkeys, I really thought you might be going down the monkey bone route, which would have been very distressing.
Oh no, I wouldn't do that. Even I wouldn't do that.
That's a terrible monkey.
Well, what about any of the monkeys from the Planet of the Apes movies?
So I it has to be said, I wouldn't go Zaius Cornelius. I would go Caesar. I'm a big Caesar stan.
The Andy Serkis Caesar?
The Andy Serkis Caesar.
Caesar Salad?
The Caesar Salad.
Caesar Salad.
Yeah.
Caesar Salad.
It would either be him or Kong. but I feel like
I think you've got these movies confused.
Not from Planet of the Apes, but I'm saying if I have a choice of a monkey,
right.
I'm torn between, which is a situation you don't want to be in, torn between Caesar and Kong.
Like Natalie
King
and Brulia.
Kong, right?
Mm.
Just to be clear.
Yes.
To give him his full name.
Well, also,
in
but
what
which
movie?
Iteration? I mean, That is the question.
I think the definitive Peter Jackson.
King Kong, as Shakespeare once said, too Kong or not too Kong, yeah, that is the question.
Yeah. Clearly the 1976 with Jeff Bridges.
Oh. Clearly. Mm. In which Rick Baker was yes. in the
Ricky
suit.
Baker.
Ricky Baker.
Once rejected, now accepted.
By the special effects community.
If you want iconic monkeys, not one per se, but the flying monkeys in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, good answer.
Because they do look amazing in their funny little costumes.
They
look
wings. Amazing.
This
and
is the best
they have
question.
Wings. Yeah, okay. Even though they're also kind of scary, I prefer that to your first two
but
answers.
They have the same outfit as Abu from Aladdin, but are not as cool. So
Aladdin.
I'm saying Abu would be a better choice
Abu.
Than a flying monkey.
That's a great answer
you've,
also.
No, you've gone for Steve. Steve, you've got Steve. Oh. Steve's on the Mount Rushmore.
Oh, you've just put him up there.
I've put him up there.
I gave you two names. I'm
I didn't
out.
Like the first one.
Wow. Have you only put one monkey mentioned so far?
So far, yeah. So far, because you've given out various options, but you haven't zeroed in on the one that you want.
I feel like we need to put King Kong in the mountain, because if we don't, there's the chance that King Kong will come along and punch the mountain out of existence.
I feel King Kong is the mountain.
James, are you saying Kong then? You go for
no,
Kong?
No, do you know what? If I'm picking, it's going to be Caesar over Kong. I've got to be honest. I have more of an emotional connection to Caesar than I do to Kong.
This is controversial.
I mean, is it?
Yes.
I have done away with Kong.
So not Roddy McDowall, you want Andy Serkis?
Yeah, I do.
I feel like that's all right. We can allow that.
All right.
I did like Dundas or whatever his name was in Gladiator 2. He was a good comedy value.
He was.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And he's the highest ranked of any of the monkeys here.
He made him council, didn't he?
I mean, yeah. But he's no whatever is Betsy from Outbreak.
Caesar was a general by the end. He led an army.
Yeah, but he was a consul of all Rome.
That is true. He definitely outranked Caesar.
He would have put himself on Mount Rushmore.
If Caesar had been a Caesar, no, that would be a discussion. But and then he founded wasn't a Caesar. He was only the Caesar, you know, it's different.
No, it's very different. Then he founded a paper company in Scranton, Pennsylvania, of course.
Do we have to keep coming up with more until you're satisfied? Is that
no, I'm happy. But okay, what's your choice then, Alex? So he's gone with Caesar. Andy Serkis, for which one?
Hail Caesar.
From which movie?
I'm going to go with Dawn.
Oh, so you've changed your answer now. You want Dawn. I don't know that one. You want Caesar from Dawn.
Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
All right. And you've gone for Steve.
Apparently.
What about old-timey shit?
I said King Kong.
Monkeys versus Hollywood,
like,
Helen.
However.
Come on.
What's the one with Cary Grant and the monkey?
Are you thinking of bringing up Baby?
Possibly.
That's a leopard, mostly.
There's one with a monkey.
It's an animal.
I don't know. I see an animal, I try and feed it. That's
my motto.
That's my motto. there's a film in which there's a monkey.
There is. I'm trying to remember it myself.
Is there a monkey and monkey business? The Marx Brothers.
No.
I should have mailed it to the Marx Brothers.
No.
There is a chimpanzee and monkey business, the Cary Grant monkey business.
Right, but not
that. That's it. That's fucking that one I was talking about. Cary Grant and a monkey, and you scoffed at me.
And Marilyn
you
Monroe.
And Marilyn Monroe!
Yeah. But no.
You like old timey shit. Would you put those on ahead of Steve?
Come on.
Steve!
We've got King Kong to talk about. Mighty Joe Young comes before Monkey Business, and Mighty Joe Young isn't going on this. Yeah, he's not going on this.
All right. We're not putting fucking Mighty Joe Young on this
No, because he's a Kong wannabe, so we should have Kong on there.
Yeah,
come
right.
on.
Uh-huh. Alex, who have you flumped for?
I'm with the flying monkey for pure, you know.
Yeah, that's iconic.
I mean, why? You can't even name the monkey.
It doesn't matter.
That's just a generic monkey with wings.
Can you name all the presidents on Mount Rushmore?
Of course.
Come on.
I can.
There's
Steve.
Ted.
Steve.
Four Steve.
Peter Talk.
Oh, boy. The head of the flying monkeys is actually called Chisteri, I'm just saying.
Chisteri?
Is that mentioned in any of the...
Wicked, right?
It's certainly in Wicked.
I think it's in Wicked,
others.
Yeah.
And it's the same dude.
Well, it's the same dude. It's a prequel, you know.
But are they saying, is there some connective tissue between him definitely being the one that, you know, flies around in 1938 or whatever it was?
Well, it depends on your view of the prequels.
So, when did Wizard of Oz come out?
1939.
Okay.
Is this monkey also a Nazi?
You asking me?
I'm asking you. You seem to be very up on Nazi monkeys. This monkey came out in 1939. I'm just saying.
Well.
Coincidence?
He was just following orders.
Oh!
This monkey business has got out of hand.
Well, They laughed at me when I proposed this question. They're not laughing now because they've heard our answers. All right, so we've gone for the flying monkeys from The Wizard of Oz. That's up there. Hail Caesar is up there. And Helen has gone, of course, famously for her favorite movie monkey, Steve, from Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and its superior sequel. you've backed me into a corner here. I thought one of you, especially you better man stands, would really go to bat.
I love Better Man, but I can't in good conscience put it on the Mount Rushmore of movie.
Well, yeah, because then essentially you're saying Robbie Williams would be Mount Rushmore.
And I'll be honest.
Which, fine.
If you're not going to say King Kong, I have to change Steve to King Kong.
I have to say King Kong
you
now.
You have to say King Kong. But it's embarrassing if you don't.
I love Clyde.
We all love Clyde. He's an orangutan, objectively the best species.
They are the best species. Orangutan, there's an orangutan chauffeur in the Cannonball Run 2.
Almost certainly the same monkey, right?
Wow, bloody hell. I feel like I'm boxed in because you know what? I don't love Kong the way that most people love Kong. I like Kong. I'm a respecter of his work. I wouldn't argue with Kong to his face.
Which Kong would you pick if you had to pick a Kong?
I'm going
Who
to be
is the king of Kong?
Can I say? I would go for the Peter Jackson Kong.
What the fuck?
Sorry, everybody. I fucking love it.
Absolutely not.
Well, yeah, but hang on. Do you mean the film over the original film or just that portrayal of the character?
Certainly that portrayal of the character. Mm. Possibly both.
He definitely emotes more.
Good ice skating scene.
Good ice skating. Like, good sunset watching scene. I really like that Kong.
Is that film not a little bit boring?
We can't have two Andy Serkis monkeys on this.
But he's a
Mount
monkey
Rushmore.
Specialist.
He's cornered the market.
He has.
Did you say he's conquered the market?
No.
Oh, you should have done. okay. I'm going to put my monkey where my mouth is. Steve, flying monkey, Caesar, Clyde from Everywhere But Loose is on the Mount Rushmore of monkeys. Helen, you have a chance to change your mind.
Kong.
Which one?
For
Peter
Steve.
Jackson. Peter Jackson.
Yep.
For Steve. Oh, Steve.
Oh, Steve is not a great loss.
We hardly knew ye, but let it be known that I was okay with no Kong on this Mount Rushmore of monkeys. Anyone going to bat for the monkey from the monkey?
Haven't seen.
Too scary.
Absolutely not.
Oh, okay. All right. Kong, possibly Nazi flying monkey.
Absolutely not Nazi
Caesar. Yes, not a Nazi, and I've gone for... Clyde.
Apes together strong.
Apes together strong, indeed. Oh, my word. What a joy that question was for us, if not the people listening to it at home. No idea where we're going next week. I will announce it on a social media platform of my choice, or maybe even the Empire subreddit. So keep them peeled. Shall we have a guest?
Let's.
Why not? Is it a monkey?
No.
No. No,
okay. That's Pamela disappointing. Well, very much not.
It is Pamela Anderson, who is the star of The Last Showgirl, Gia Coppola's The Last Showgirl, which is out this week in cinemas and stars Pamela Anderson. This is her, how would you describe it? A big comeback? Anyway, Alex, how would you describe this
comeback
one for her?
As well, but it's also like the first proper meaty dramatic lead role she's ever had. I mean, don't...
Hey, Barb Wire.
Yes, ha-ha. No. Barbed Wire is absolutely terrible, and I don't know if you'd call that a meaty dramatic lead role.
The movie Casablanca wanted to be.
But she's a real cinephile. I don't know if anyone listening saw her appearance in the Criterion Closet, but she knows her onions. She's really, really, really...
She was in the wrong closet.
She really, really, really loves films and cinema, and I think this is the sort of role that she would have loved to have played over the past 10, 20, 30 years, but was never given the chance or the opportunity for reasons. But she's really, really good in it.
Because people pigeonholed her after Baywatch and Barbed Wire. And they pigeonholed her after sex tape.
Which was wildly unjust on many, many levels. Sexism, it's bad. Anyway, let's move on.
What would you know, woman?
To be honest, that's why I think it's. I don't know if it's quite right to call it a comeback, because she's not coming back from similar territory. It's almost like a bit of a rebirth or like a new phase for her. And she's really great in it, and I hope to see her in a lot more of these sort of films.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, here is Alex talking to Pamela Anderson about The Last Showgirl. Do please enjoy.
Good morning, Pamela Anderson. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing great.
How long are you in London for? A while?
Just a couple more days, then I'm off to Paris and then to LA and then home.
Globetrotting.
Yeah, I've come over to Europe a few times in the last few months, but it's fun. I can't complain. I'm in London.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
More or less.
Yeah, a little jet lag, but hey, sometimes it's easier to do these interviews when you're, a little bit scattered.
On a natural high.
Yeah, something.
Well, this is for Empire Podcast. Thanks so much for doing it. I absolutely love this film. Oh, I was just mentioning to you earlier, we've done it in the magazine. We spoke to you for the magazine. I've seen the film twice. I'm just absolutely in love with it. It's just a beautiful, sparkling, on many levels, piece of work. And just for our listeners, it covers the dying days of this whole era of Vegas showgirls. And your character, Shelley, I guess you'd say, is having trouble letting go of everything. You know, it's the scene is coming to an end. Her career, possibly in some ways, coming to an end. And you do such a great job of conveying that desperation and that hunger and that hope in the face of so many obstacles. And it's just a great little character study. That's what does it for me.
Oh, it's a great character to play.
Yeah. Gia Coppola, was... This is a fantastic script, and she wanted you and no one else for it. And you're so perfect for it. And it feels to me like, well, I know it's been a great leading role like this has been a long time coming for you. And it's so great to see how perfectly it fits. I was wondering, when you read it and also when you set about making the film, I know you shot it really quickly. Did you feel that sort of the weight of everything that it was and everything that it meant to you and everything that it could do to you, rather than it's not just another acting job or another great acting job? I know it meant a lot to you. So what was it like sort of having that on your shoulders as you went about doing it?
Oh, I had nothing to lose. Yeah. So I knew that I could just commit myself fully and use all these things that I had learned. And I love that Gia could see through the nonsense and see me in the documentary, as a woman really aching to express herself as an artist. I thought From Baywatch to Broadway, that had a nice ring to it. And, I did play Roxy in Chicago on Broadway, and that was just the warm-up. But that was exciting. It was almost part of the research for this character to have that backstage banter and to live it and see it and see these people that have been in this industry for so long, this muscle memory, talking about what they're going to have for dinner and then hearing their cue and going on stage and then continuing the conversation when they get off the stage in a couple minutes. That's real. But I could hear the voice. I could see how I could play her. And this is the first time I've ever experienced anything like that. I mean, I've done TV shows. And for me, it was I'm always very visually excited about things where I could see what they would look like. But I did dive into the internal workings of a character until this point. And I never thought I'd get the chance because, being part of pop culture is a blessing. But also, I think you start at a little bit of a deficit explaining to people you're a human being and that you have feelings and then that you can be a character. So I know I've got a uphill battle, but I'm a fighter and I work very hard and I'm excited. I'm taking the challenge on.
That all comes through in the film and the performance, I mean, Gia spoke to us for the magazine about the fact that she saw enough similarities between you and Shelley, but also enough differences that you could bring yourself to it while creating this character. And I think all of that is really effective. And something that I think is really distinctive about what you do with Shelley in the film is that everything's sort of on the surface with her. She doesn't hide anything. She holds nothing back. And the way you express yourself facially is you're just all out there. And I think that's really refreshing, because there's not much subtext with Shelley. She's just there and you're sort of signifying how you feel all the time. And I wondered how much of that was sort of on the page or how much of that was something that you wanted to bring with it or just happened on the day.
All of it. I really wanted to. I worked on it for months before we got started. There was the strike. There was all sorts of things that kind of delayed the filming of it. And I was able to work on it in writing. I love to write. So a lot of emotional diaries, a lot of things that I did that I shredded after the film. I mean, I've shredded all my notes. Yeah. It was so revealing. And so I really wanted to dive into the depths of feeling what it feels like to be in this industry that's a little bit about being objectified, but not seeing that in the moment and realizing it later, reassessing your life choices, and also raising children alongside.
Yeah.
Pursuing your dreams, but also being kind of unaware in some ways. And so there was so much I could bring to it. And so I could just, I know, I mean, when I saw the character for the first time, I saw the film for the first time at TIFF with the entire cast, you know, I looked up and went, wow, like I don't see myself there. Like that's Shelley. Mm. And that's the first time I've ever experienced that. I know people talk about these things, but how would I know? And plus I didn't really know if what I was doing was working. You know, it was funny on set, we would do some scenes and people would start clapping after. I was like, what is going on? Like, I don't really get this. And then, you know, just to see that people are feeling what I'm feeling is really exciting, but this is a whole new experience. It's not, I don't think I've done anything really before I did this role that was of any significance. And so I'm happy, except for playing Roxy in Chicago. That was kind of like the catalyst, because to dance and sing really kind of opens you up. And that gave me an opportunity to kind of try again and with being really open and vulnerable. And that's a likable character. I think it's very easy to play her maybe bitter or jaded or angry.
Yeah.
And I felt, no, she's doing the best she can with the tools that she has. And I wanted to fill her full of hope and joy, even though she had a boiling point, you know, her bandwidth was only so much. And there was those moments where she slammed the door on a friend who was really in need.
Yeah.
Because that's all she had, you know, and I feel like that was very real, really relatable.
It's really sad, that moment.
Yeah.
What were there moments, and we're talking about, you've been talking about creating this character and everything that you wanted to do with her, but like I said, Gia certainly saw things in you that she thought there was a connection there, here and there. Were there moments where you felt that on set, where you felt like there was some of you and your life experience going into what was coming out of you?
Well, with, you know, I experiment too with like substitution and different parts of things. So, and I write a lot. So it was getting a lot of your life experience down on the page and that is similar to what you're going through, but then putting that aside. Mm. So when you're in the moment, you know, I don't know what's going on, but you've done the work and you have to trust that you've done it. And so to see it afterwards is when I really thought, wow, you mean nothing, you can't hide anything in the eyes. My life is passing before my eyes. You know, I can see it and I know, but it just happens. And that's what you have to trust, is that you don't have to be thinking about your own personal life in a moment. You can't. It's just, you do the work, it's all in you, it's all percolating in you. And then when you do the scenes, it's there's some kind of magic that happens where it just takes over. And, you know, I don't think I'm the person people are going to go to for acting advice, but I'm learning. I'm like a sponge. I just soaked it all in like a sponge, and I feel like I still am. I feel like there's so much to it with body movement, how you hold your hands, just how you express yourself and your voice. And the more you can bring to it, the better it is.
There's a line in there. I was watching it again the other day, and there's one line that really cut through to me. I don't want to spoil it because it's quite late, I don't want to spoil the sort of the context. But there's a line where Shelley goes, "I'm not going to defend myself anymore." Mm-hmm. And she's basically saying, "It is what it is. I am what I am, and I'm fed up with having to answer for myself. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to live in the past anymore." And that felt really loaded to me, you know, because you think you do bring. You know, we've seen you before. We know you. You know, and when Shelley says that line, I just thought there was a lot going on there. I thought.
Yeah, or people think they know me. So
well, exactly.
That's the thing. I mean, I feel like, you know, when I do interviews now too, if people have seen the film, they ask me certain questions. If they haven't seen the film, I still feel like I'm explaining myself, and I feel like that moment. I don't want to explain myself anymore.
Yeah.
I want to be. I did the best I could. And that's what I think this character is so interesting, is that she wears her heart in her sleeve, but she's not a pushover.
Yeah.
You know, and the film is about second chances.
Did that mean a lot to you when you read it? Because I think in the film, there's a lot of disrespect and rejection that Shelley endures. And like you say, you wanted to make her very hopeful, and she is very optimistic in it. But she's also sort of breaking in front of us. But is when you read all that stuff, did you feel like, I can do that? I know how to do
that. Yeah, I can do that. And I think there has to be a breaking point to move on. There is, it's always darkest before the dawn, you know, it's, and she had to break because she's been holding everything together. Just, you know, by the skin of her teeth, she's just, and so that's what this movie is about. It's about that point of, it's reinvention. Like this part of my life is over, even though all I have put into it, and was it worth it? You know, where am I, my child? I've, you know, left her to the neighbors. It's,
yeah,
you just hits you all at once. And there are moments like that in everybody's life. So, male, female, you know, there's just, it's a universal thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really effective. I found it really sad.
Well, it's also hopeful.
Yeah.
It's sad, but it's hopeful because you have to hit that time. You have to go, okay, now what? Yeah, now what? And I think that's what's fun about the having a shorter film, in a way, is there's a lot left to the imagination. You bring a lot to it. Like, where does Shelley go? I think she's, you know, I think it's very hopeful. I think she needed this. Then she'll figure out the rest. She's resilient. She's been through this business. It's not easy.
Yeah.
She's going to, you know, be fine.
I know you were inspired and influenced by a lot of the actual showgirls who you met in preparation and during the filming. Was there, I believe you spent quite a bit of time sort of intimately with some of them. Was there anyone in particular that who made a really big impression on you or who really imprinted something on you some way?
Yeah, I've met many showgirls since I've done the film. But before, there's just the great, you know, wonderful showgirls I met in Las Vegas. Diane, this woman who, she's just so proud of her art form. And I think that was really interesting to hear is like what they're doing now. Like some are working in real estate, some are, you know, dance instructors and I don't know, it was eye-opening to meet them and also to know that they always say they're not burlesque dancers, they don't wear pasties, they didn't mingle with people out in the casinos. They were treated like movie stars.
Yeah.
And then it kind of just slowly went away. And to have 85 women on stage and 45 people in the crew and 15 people in the audience must have been heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And you know it's over.
Yeah.
And you know just people need more to be entertained these days.
Okay, so my final question, you were just mentioning before that this is sort of a reinvention for her. I wouldn't say that it's a reinvention for you. That sounds a bit too dramatic, but it certainly feels like it's the start of a new phase for you. And it's been so successful. I mean, it's just such a great film, and you got your Golden Globe nomination, deservedly so. How has all that kudos and all the love and support that the film's been getting, that you've been getting, has it changed the way that you feel about the business or about yourself or about life?
Well, I feel I'm gaining a little bit more confidence. It's been hard to kind of walk into these rooms. It's very intimidating. But it's been a practice for me to think, no, I belong here. I'm okay. I'm supposed to be here, because there is that, you know, voice in my head that says, you know, what is she doing here? You know, I don't want to be here if she's here. Like, I have the same sometimes negative connotations when I hear my name. I think, oh no, I don't want to be here with her. Like so it's a practice, and I know it's going to take some time to get used to that. But doing this role really has opened me up, and I get so many calls from actors and directors that love the film, like people I never would have expected. So it's very exciting, but it is, and I think that's a lesson. There's a lesson there that we have to, you know, not be so hard on ourselves, but also be open to a new experience, because you can imprison yourself. And I feel like I've created all these characters in the past, you know, that became Halloween costumes. But they were made with love, and they had a lot went into all those creations. But this is a time where I can really show my heart and my soul. And so to be loved and embraced for my work is really exciting. I never thought I'd get the chance.
Oh, well, it's so deserved. You're so great in it. And I hope you can tell how much I love the film. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Pamela Anderson. We will be reviewing The Last Showgirl later on in the show. We're going to talk about movie news now. And obviously, there is quite a lot of movie news that's happened this week. And a lot of it of the very, very somber variety. We're recording this about 2, maybe 3 hours or so after the news was announced of the sad deaths of Gene Hackman, the great Gene Hackman, and his wife, Betsy Arakawa. Gene Hackman was 95, and his wife was 63, and they were found dead in their home in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Anyone who listens to this podcast on a regular basis will know, of course, what Gene Hackman means to me. He is my favorite actor of all time. I consider him to be the greatest actor of all time. But this feels so fresh and so sensitive at the moment that we're not going to talk about Gene Hackman too much on this week's show. We're gonna wait until next week before we really do our proper tribute to Gene Hackman. But very, very shocking and sad news indeed.
Absolutely. I mean, he had retired a long time ago now, but it still feels like a massive loss to cinema just because of the long length of his career and the incredible work that he did. And she was a classical musician as well.
Yep, classical pianist. Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, just very, very, very sad news. There's been a lot of that this week. I think people were rocked also yesterday by the very early death of Michelle Trachtenberg at the age of only 39.
Yeah.
So, of course, the star, for many of us, the star of Buffy, for a generation, the star of Harriet the Spy, for a slightly later generation, or maybe the same ones grown up, the star of Gossip Girl, or one of the stars of Gossip Girl. Just, you know.
Euro Trip.
Ice Princess, actually, which is genuinely quite a decent little teen movie.
Right.
Just, you know, she'd just been tweeting about the Buffy reboot and, you know, sort of coming back to that. So it really is a bit of a shock and a huge, huge loss for people who just, you know, spent large parts of their lives growing up alongside her. So, so yeah, it's just been what a week. And those weren't the only two.
No, Roberto Orsi also this week died. I believe it was 51. I remember Roberto Orsi and Alex Kurtzman pretty much dominated screenwriting for a period and kind of like, was it the early sort of 2010s?
Big budget sort of blockbuster screenwriting. Well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Working on things like Star Trek, Transformers films. They worked on Fringe as well.
Cowboys and Aliens.
Right, all that sort of stuff. I think he stepped back a little bit in recent years. Alex Kurtzman obviously has been doing Star Trek for a while, so their partnership kind of broke up. But yeah, very sad news.
Yeah, very, very sad news. Indeed, just 51 years old, Roberto Orsi, and he appeared on this podcast. I think with Kurtzman, the Star Trek Into Darkness spoiler special. I think you can hear him on that. I interviewed him a couple of times. Seemed like a lovely guy. Very, very sad indeed. 51, no age at all. Michelle Trachtenberg, so, so sad indeed. And I think we're all still processing the news about Gene Hackman and his wife, which is just absolutely awful. But if you were to watch a Gene Hackman film tonight in tribute, what would it be?
Unforgiven.
Interesting.
That's a good call.
Yeah. Deserves got nothing to do with it.
That's right.
Won his second Oscar, of course, for that as Little Bill Daggett.
That's right. Killed
first Oscar.
Anything that walked or crawled the one time.
Indeed. First Oscar, of course, was for The French Connection, playing Popeye Doyle. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, it'd be The Royal Tenenbaums, which is also my favorite Wes Anderson movie. And I think he's just incredible in that. I think, you know, he's such a good serious actor that I think people didn't always give him credit for his comic chops, but
Birdcage.
He shows both in that. Yes.
So funny in Birdcage.
So funny. But he's just, and Superman, really funny in Superman. But he's just magisterial in The Royal Tenenbaums. That's my all-time favorite of his.
Chris, I'm assuming yours will be The Quick and the Dead.
I honestly don't know. It's a tricky one. I mean, Hackman, well, again, we'll talk about him properly next week, but he was such a great actor. He was never less than great in a film. He could elevate the schlockiest of material. He could make a terrible film watchable, a watchable film good, a good film great, and a great film an all-timer, I think, just by his sheer presence. And honestly, I'm spoiled for choice. If I'm going to recommend something that listeners may not have seen, I would recommend a 1973 film he did with Al Pacino called Scarecrow, which is absolutely terrific. Kind of two drifters. He's a blustering kind of confidence man who hooks up with Al Pacino's deserter from the army, if I remember rightly, and they go on an odyssey together, and it's a very tragic film, but my God, they're absolutely amazing together.
That's the one he considered his best work, I think.
I think it is, reading
some stories this morning.
And he's great in things like Night Moves as well, which is another cracking film from the 70s. The fact that he was able to remain relevant and remain a movie star and an actor of such magnetism across, what, 4 or 5 decades is absolutely astonishing. I've got a soft spot for one of the last films he ever made, Runaway Jury. He's great in that. It's Rankin Fitch. What a great name.
The Conversation.
The Conversation, oh my God. Superman, he is my Lex Luthor. He is the ruler of Australia. I don't know, Alex, while I have a little think, what about you?
Do you know what I think is really interesting about him? I was thinking before, I mean, you were just talking about how great he was comedically, Helen. And, you know, I would watch Royal Tenenbaums tonight as well because I love that film with my whole heart and him in it. And Superman, obviously, is a very broad comedic role. But even when he was doing comedy, and Ants, by the way, he's incredible voicing Ants. I think he's a general in it or something, obviously. But he, even when he was being funny, I think he was still playing on the gruffness and the gravitas. You know, he always had that. So he always brought that weight. And so, you know, so he's playing Lex Luthor and he's playing it broad and he's playing it silly and there's some slapstick in it, but he's still formidable in it. And the same with Tenenbaums. Yeah. It's like he's this patriarch who has got no filter. You don't fuck with him. And he's quite threatening, but he's also completely lovable in it, which is such a fine tightrope to walk, you know? Yeah. I think it was absolutely brilliant. And it's, for me, a man of a certain age, there were different phases of Hackman. So when I was a kid, Superman was a big thing aside, but I think my first memory of him was Poseidon Adventure, which is just one of those films you watched. It was always on TV, and I would watch it with my mum and dad all the time. And so there was that. And then, you know, you get into film more as you're growing up and you're watching The French Connection, you're watching The Conversation. And then in the 90s, you mentioned Unforgiven James and there was Ants. And then, you know, Tenenbaums.
The Firm, even.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And then you're getting into, you know, the swan song period before he retired. I mean, he was never, ever not brilliant. I mean, you mentioned Runaway Jury, Chris, which I don't think is a masterpiece of the film.
But it's not a masterpiece, but it's a film I rewatch quite a lot.
Really?
Yeah. I watch it once every 2 years or so. I'll think, oh, I really fancy Runaway Jury because it's a really, really nicely made piece of popcorn entertainment. I eat up courtroom dramas and he's great. And he gets a scene in it with Dustin Hoffman. It looks like we are talking about Gene Hackman after all, but he gets a scene in it with Dustin Hoffman, who was his former roommate in college. And they kind of both hit it big around the same time in 1967. Hoffman with The Graduate, Hackman with Bonnie and Clyde, for which he was nominated
for an Oscar. And their other roommate was Robert Duvall. I mean, what a house, my God.
With the stories they can tell.
He's one of those actors that you could never ever accuse of phoning it in.
No.
He always brought everything he had. I mean, even to material that didn't deserve him, I would say, like Superman 4.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, Superman 4, Quest for Peace.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, we'll talk about him probably next week, but there's so many great, great films. I'm looking on a Just Watch right now because I want to say something that people can actually watch tonight if they want to, because
Crimson Tide's got to be on somewhere.
Crimson Tide, Disney Plus. Yeah, that's obviously an amazing film. I'm going to give a shout out. This is not necessarily the film that you should watch tonight. This is not Gene Hackman's finest film by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a film I have a lot of affection for, and it's Peter Hyams' remake of The Narrow Margin, simply called Narrow Margin. And Gene Hackman is a lawyer who has to get Ann Archer's witness to a mob killing to across country. So they go onto a train, but they're pursued by hitmen who don't know what she looks like. And it's really good. Yeah. It's like 90 minutes long. It's mostly set in the train. I eat train movies up as well.
That sounds like it might be relevant for one of our reviews later. Let's talk about that then.
It may well be. It's not quite like that, but it's it's in the ballpark. But listen, tremendously, tremendously sad news. Our heart goes out to their family as well. But we will talk properly about Gene Hackman next week. But awfully sad news about Gene Hackman and his wife, Betsy Arakawa. Okay. What else has been happening in the world of movie news, folks?
It's been a weirdly big week. So we had a bunch of trailers. Finally, we got a trailer for Havoc, which delivers Havoc, as promised. A lot of it. There's a lot of the punching and the smashing and the shooting and the violence.
This is Havoc
This is the Gareth Evans action film starring Tom Hardy.
Ooh.
It's been coming for a while. It has been sort of held up by strikes and all sorts of things. The official synopsis is that Hardy plays a bruised detective fighting his way through a criminal underworld that threatens to engulf his entire city after a drug deal gone wrong. Mm. And he's got basically all of the factions after him. Including Timothy Olyphant.
Timothy Olyphant with great hair. Yes.
Great hair, all is well in my world. This looks super fun.
Yeah, this is the return to action of Gareth Evans, who, for my money, is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, action director on the planet. And it's been a while since we had a Gareth Evans action movie. We obviously had Gangs of London, the first season of Gangs of London, specifically the farmhouse episode, episode 5, which is extraordinary. But it's been over 10 years since The Raid 2 was released. And this is the first time we're going to get to see him breaking bones and smashing heads and shooting people in parts of their bodies. It's just my happy place, generally. So I'm excited about this. April 25th on Netflix. Woo-hoo. Anyway, anything else?
So
happening?
Much other news.
So right. Much other. There was an Andor season 2 trailer.
Oh my God,
which
it looks
very
amazing.
Very exciting. Soundtracked, perhaps controversially, by The Revolution Starts Now by Steve Earle, which isn't what you'd call standard Star Wars music, but it's got attitude and it's got confidence, and everything in that trailer made me so excited.
I liked how unsubtle it was.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Somebody recut it to Kendrick Lamar's
Of course they
just
did.
Like, not like us, and it works.
You can cut that to anything and it would be great.
Well, that also, but it works exceptionally well in the case of Andor. I'm here for it. I'm so excited for that show.
Well, yeah. Wait. Mm. Talking of Star Wars, should we discuss Kathleen Kennedy's rumored, reported exit from Lucasfilm. But let's bear in mind, there's been no official announcement about that whatsoever. But so they say, by the end of 2025, she's going to, I quote, step down.
Yeah.
Mm.
I quote, reported quotes.
Who are you quoting at this point?
So it's the end of an extremely successful but not uncontroversial era.
Yeah, agreed. Say. She's been, what, 13 years in post, is it?
Pretty much, yeah.
Feels like longer.
Yeah.
That's a long time in post. They must be finished by now.
I think she's probably done, with some caveats, what she wanted to do.
Yeah.
Which they paid a lot of money for Star Wars, and it wasn't to release a film every 4 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have. I mean, yeah, there have been successes and there have been perceived failures.
Yeah.
There have been films announced that didn't happen.
Many of them.
Yeah. But there's been some really good stuff in there. And I think... I don't think you can argue with the exploration of what Star Wars can do and what Star Wars can be. Whether you're not, like, we're not going to love all of it anyway, but she has paved the way for Star Wars to mean different things to different people.
True.
And it's a big universe, and there's no reason for it not to be that.
I don't hold... She gets a lot of shit for everything that's happened in Star Wars. I don't think any of it can really be laid at her feet personally. I think she did what she was hired to do, mm-hmm. which is she was handed the keys to this thing and told to take it forward in this very specific direction, which is what she did very successfully. You could argue that this isn't creatively the best direction that Star Wars could have gone in, and I think that's absolutely fair. But given that it was sold as a property to make money, I think she was successful in what she undertook to do with it.
And what she's done with it is now, you know, the big part of the conversation with Bond as well. It's like, happened to Star Wars going to happen to Bond?
IP farming, yes.
Yeah. Mm. It's interesting, you know, but I think Barbara Broccoli, we talked about it last week, obviously on the show, that Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson stepping down from handling the reins of Bond after so long. I think it's a slightly different situation in that Bond was a family business. Eon Productions was a family business. The name Broccoli has been on every official, quote-unquote, Bond movie since 1962, whereas Kathleen Kennedy was someone who was hired to come in and play with George Lucas's toys, essentially. But it is, obviously, we have had two, and this is just a rumor, of course, but two huge female titans in the industry stepping down from their queendom in the last week and a half.
Yeah, I think it's I don't know. It's I think she had a difficult road. I don't think every decision was necessarily the best one. I think, you know, we're all upset that there, you know, some films that were made and some films that fell by the wayside. There was some stuff in there that sounded incredible that never got off the drawing board. Mm. And some of the stuff that did get off the drawing board, Book of Boba Fett maybe shouldn't have, you know. So no one's going to say it was like a 100% hit rate. But yeah, it does feel like we're moving away from personalities, actually, not just women, but personalities running film businesses and more towards
creative personalities.
Yes, creative personalities and going more towards, you know, this kind of slightly grey algorithmic approach.
Would you describe her as a creative? Because I always struck her as she was very business focused and she was very successful at that.
But look where she's come from though.
Absolutely. And her past absolutely speaks for that. But I think in her tenure at Lucasfilm, it was she was driving a business forward rather than, I think, in my opinion, executing a creative vision.
No, but I think she was hiring creative people to try and do that, which I'm not sure is, yeah.
But I don't think it was one creative vision. I think she's just, like I said, it's lots and lots of different things.
And yes, and I think, certainly speaking personally, I think that was always the thing that I bumped on with her tenure there, is I felt like what it needed was a Feige-type figure to kind of draw the narrative threads together creatively. Because I think the biggest problem with the sequel trilogy was there was no coherent vision for those films.
Well, it swings,
and I think that set the tone for Star
Wars. It swings and roundabouts, isn't it? Mm. Because, I agree the biggest problem with that trilogy is they made it. I cannot believe, for all that money and everything that trilogy could have been, that they didn't have a plan for three films cohesively. They made it up from film to film and said, you deal with this one, and then you deal with this one. Having said that, The Last Jedi is a masterpiece. So,
it is. I agree with you. But, I mean, these things happen. I mean, look, we're talking about Bond. It feels like No Time to Die was a film, but when they finished that, they had no real coherent vision for how to take that franchise forward afterwards. So it does happen.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think starting out a new era with no concrete narrative plan was a flawed approach, in my opinion.
I agree with that, actually.
Yeah. It's been, you know, however much of what she's done you've loved, however much you haven't loved, it has been haphazard.
Yeah, I think so.
But also, I think she should be applauded in a way for they could have flooded cinemas with substandard Star Wars movies over the last few years, and one of them would have hit, and they would have made a billion, and everyone would have been happy from a shareholder point of view. But
lest we forget, George Lucas did release the Clone Wars cartoon feature film in cinemas. And it was
I saw it in a cinema,
Yes. Go on, Jake.
I gave that 3 stars.
Which one? The Genndy Tartakovsky one?
No, the one
with the baby Jabba.
One of a bunch of Jabbas.
Oh.
Which was the first Clone Wars.
I think it was Filoni directed, actually.
It was.
That was 2008, wasn't it?
I forget what year it was around.
She did exercise quality control.
But
that's fair.
I don't think the strategy for Star Wars can be laid at her feet. I think it doesn't matter who was in charge of that, this is where it would have gone. Mm. And the nature of that deal was to tee up IP farming. Like, that's what it was.
There's also a lot more to this story than Kathleen Kennedy.
Yeah.
We don't know what the choices were, what was driving all the choices and where they all came from. But like I said, I love The Last Jedi. And also, she gave us Andor.
She did.
So
absolutely,
you don't
gave
have
us
to
Andor.
Like it all.
And The Mandalorian. Love The Mandalorian.
Yeah, and look, not all of the small screen stuff has hit. And I do, I've many times
not all the
bemoaned
big screen stuff's hit.
Also true. I have bemoaned the de-eventizing of Star Wars, but that is very much the era we're in. And I don't think it's something that can be leveled specifically at Star Wars.
I think it isn't.
Where we are at the moment.
But I think somebody needs to
make it stop. Absolutely.
It.
But, I also think, by the way, I think her intention, from what I gather, has been, regardless of the results and whatever you like or don't like, I think her intention was always quality control.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is, like I say, whatever the end product, this director or these directors aren't working out, we need to retool this.
Yes,
or
I agree.
You know, whatever happened at the end, the intention was, let's try and make the best Star Wars we can.
I think that's true. I think Rogue One's an interesting one. I don't think certainly maybe one day we'll know exactly what happened behind the scenes there, but I think Rogue One was a little bit a victim of Force Awakens box office. I think when it made that much money, the proposition of what Rogue One was fundamentally shifted. But look, if that hadn't happened, we never would have had Tony Gilroy come in. We never would have had Andor. So I'm not necessarily questioning it, but...
Who knows what Solo would have been like before the changes were made? Who knows what Rogue One would have been like before the changes were made?
Yeah.
And we don't
know. We will never know.
The fact of the matter is, I don't want to give away too much about Rogue One, but that's still an incredibly bold film. The way that film ends, triumphant. But the way that film ends is for a major blockbuster that cost hundreds of millions of dollars and made over a billion.
Yes, it did.
I don't think it's spoilery.
I don't know. I don't want to.
They
get
all
accused.
Die.
Oh, for fuck's sake! All right, you can shout at James, not me. Kathleen Kennedy, of course, had a career, a very successful one, before
she did.
She was wrapped up in the Sarlacc pit that is Star Wars. She's been nominated 8 times as a producer of a Best Picture nominee.
Mm-hmm.
Can you name those 8 movies?
Oh, God.
This is a quiz. It's a fun little quiz. It's a sub-quiz. Here we go. The 8 movies that Kathleen Kennedy has produced that have been nominated for Best Picture, none of them have won.
Is there a Jurassic in there?
No.
Lincoln.
I tell you right now, you're not going to get these.
Arachnophobia.
Having said that, Helen just got one.
Hey!
Lincoln.
Yes.
You are the Lincoln lawyer.
I take back arachnophobia.
The color purple?
Same. Arachnophobia should have been nominated.
It should have been nominated.
The color purple. Helen is 2 for 2 so far.
Is it all Spielberg films?
No.
Is it all obscure Spielberg films?
I will say that at least 2 of these are... Okay, 5 of them are Spielberg films.
Wait, Schindler's List won, so it can't be Schindler's List.
She did not produce Schindler's
right,
List.
Okay. Always wasn't nominated, was it?
Oh, dear God, no.
Well, I'm just checking.
Do you want clues?
Yes.
Amistad.
Yes.
No!
Seriously?
Yes! Might have been nominated. I don't know, but if well, she didn't produce
she
it.
She didn't produce it.
All right, so... I'm going backwards. One was in 2012, that was Lincoln. One was the year before. A Spielberg film that came out the year before, in 2011.
War of the Worlds?
Tintin.
Yes, that's right, James. It was
Tintin, famous nominee.
Fucking Tintin. Hergé's The Fucking Adventures of Tintin. No, it wasn't.
I just remember that was the year that I was, or must have been the year before, when I was on set of Tintin.
When you say you were on set of Tintin, yeah. You mean...
I was on the volume.
Yes.
I pumped up the volume.
You did. We were... That, to be more accurate, we were adjacent to the set of Tintin.
But we got to go on, right? And we got to play with the little remote control for the camera and stuff.
Well, so why were you both there, for God's sake?
We were there for a meeting, because it was the Spielberg, when he did our 20th birthday issue. We had a meeting with Kathy Kennedy.
I didn't get to go.
Steven Spielberg. I remember...
I lived in LA at the time.
Yeah, we had that meeting with Spielberg, and at one point it was a knock on the door, and it was Kathy Kennedy and Janusz Kaminski came in. And we were like, this is an unusual interruption for an Empire planning meeting.
I wasn't at that meeting, but I was... the one you were thinking about was... the day we reunited the Goonies.
Oh, I wasn't there for that.
And Spielberg was, and so I walked out of where we were reuniting the Goonies with Spielberg and Dick Donner and all the Goonies, and we came out. I walked out to try and go to the toilet at one point and walked past Spielberg and James Cameron, who had dropped by because Spielberg was filming Tintin literally next door, and they were fiddling around in their little volume type thing, their little volume remote controller lets them move the camera around virtually. And that was pretty cool. Anyway, it wasn't that. It wasn't Tintin. 2011. Okay. You know, if we were to do a Mount Rushmore of great movie horses, this one might not be on there.
War horse, no horse, war I can't horse. Take any more horse.
How dare you, sir?
Hang on. What did it win?
No, nominated.
She hasn't won for any of these. So Color Purple was right. There is another Spielberg, two more Spielberg films.
Yeah,
one from 2005.
Yeah. Oh, when was Minority Report?
That was 2002.
When was War of the Worlds?
2005. This is a film we discussed recently because it was pertinent to another movie that came out recently.
You have to remember, I don't remember our discussions from earlier today.
Nor do I. Munich.
Yes, of course.
And the first Steven Spielberg film that Kathleen Kennedy was nominated for came out in 1980.
E.T.?
Yes.
Yeah.
E.T. the Extraterrestrial. There were 3 others. One directed by Gary Ross, starring another horse.
Seabiscuit.
Yes, correct.
Oh my goodness me. A film that no one ever watched again.
Who could forget Seabiscuit?
One directed by M. Night Shyamalan.
Oh. Sixth Sense.
Correct. Ah. No one saw that twist coming. And the 8th and final film that Kathleen Kennedy has been nominated for so far, and this might be one of the reasons why she's stepping back from Star Wars to get back in the producing saddle. 2008, a film directed by David Fincher.
Oh, Benjamin Button.
Fuck you.
What?
Just when you accidentally know something about a movie, I'm really impressed.
It's because I'm getting younger with age.
I thought that.
My memory's improving as the podcast goes along.
I was genuinely wondering if you could see the reflection of my phone behind me on the screen. No, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. There you go.
Yeah.
So amazing. Hopefully she's won the Irving Thalberg, Chief Thalberg, that one. She's won that, but she hasn't won.
It's a funny old list, I will say.
The list is life. Anyway, anything else happening in the world of movie news?
Can we discuss the biggest and most important news story of the week? The news that Ayo Edebiri is going to write and possibly star in a Barney, the dinosaur movie.
Yeah.
A film that has been in development for a while with Daniel Kaluuya, right, behind the scenes?
Yeah, with A24 involved.
I don't know what this is.
I don't understand, but I hope it leans into Barney's really fucking creepiness. I'm seeing the monkey, if I'm honest, but he's a purple dinosaur. That's kind of where my head's at.
I think we can trust Io as well.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Okay, well, that sounds interesting. And that's pretty much it for movie news for this week, folks. Time for our second and final guest. Hells Bells.
Hi.
You can tell us all about Naomi Aki, who is one of the stars of Mickey 17, which is the new film from Bong Joon-ho starring Robert Pattinson and Robert Pattinson, but also other people as well, including Naomi Aki.
Yes. She is fabulous. People may remember her from The Rise of Skywalker, Blink Twice, of course, last year. Thank you, Ben. from The Rise of Skywalker, she played Whitney Houston in I Want to Dance with Somebody. She, her performance was good, even though the film was, you know, the reviews were so-so. But she's fabulous. And she is a sort of security officer on this years-long voyage to a new world in Mickey 17, which is this new sci-fi movie, as Chris said. She has a relationship with Robert Pattinson's Mickey, who is an expendable. He is someone who is given all the most dangerous jobs on the ship, and then he is human-printed out again, his memories uploaded to a new body and sent to do it all over again, or 16 times and counting, as we've learned in this film. So she has an interesting role that I don't want to say too much about, but there are some, if you're very spoiler sensitive, we do just talk about her role in the film in this in this interview. So you might want to come back and listen after you've seen it if you are spoiler sensitive.
No, that's good.
But it was very fun to chat to her and get into the detail of working with Robert Pattinson and Bong Joon-ho and approaching the whole weird sci-fi angle.
Ah, okay. All right. So this may be one you want to listen to next week, after the film has come out. But if you just like listening to the interviews, then have a go at it. Because we have Director Bong on next week's podcast. So I'm spreading the Mickey 17 love across two different podcasts. So there you go. Here is Naomi Aki. Have a listen, or wait a week and then have a listen. Enjoy.
First of all, congratulations on Mickey 17. I really enjoyed it. It's exactly my kind of like weird sci-fi craziness.
Yeah, I think that's how weird sci-fi craziness is the perfect way to describe this film.
So, I mean, tell me about how did you get involved? Like, was it, did someone send you a full script, or was it Bong Joon-ho wants a word? Or?
Yeah, it was Bong Joon-ho wants a word.
Oh my God.
Which, yeah, in any other sense, you're like, I'm in trouble. but no, I was working in Boston at the time on the Whitney Houston biopic, and I got an email from my team that was just like, Bong Joon-ho would like to chat with you. And it was like, you know, you get a lot of chats with directors, and sometimes it's just generals. Generals basically means it's like there's no particular project. You're just chatting with someone. So I kind of thought it was maybe on that wavelength. I didn't really know there was a project attached. And we were chatting and really talking about, you know, work and theatre. And he was a big fan of, like, you know, actors who had started in theatre, and that's how I started. And yeah, by the end of the meeting, he was like, okay, so I have this script, that would you want to read it? And I was like, oh, yes, please. And even then I was like, you know, if I get a chance to read it and then audition for it, that would be amazing. But what ended up happening was I read it. We had a second chat. I didn't hear from him or anyone for like 3 months. And by that point, I'd kind of forgotten about it. And then an offer came in, and it was probably one of the highlights of my career so far.
That's awesome. I guess that you kind of have to be like that as an actor, right? If something, you know, you don't hear for a while and you're like, okay, just let it go.
You just let it go. This is my 10th year of working, and, you know, I wasn't like that at the beginning. But now, you know, what's for you went past you. So many projects. There's so many amazing projects to be a part of, and you can't be a part of them all. And so, yeah, it's just the approach.
So what can you say about Nasha? Because I don't want to spoil anything.
Yeah, okay, without spoiling. I've been describing her as, there's this saying that inside every woman is a little man who judges her. Nasha doesn't have a little man inside of her. she's just really, she doesn't watch herself, and there's a lot of freedom, and that comes from that. That's what I really got, is that she is genuinely fully herself in any moment. So, you know, she has this job that you would presume would put her in a certain space where she would behave a certain way, but she doesn't. She's wildly expressive and emotional in the greatest sense. She knows how she feels, and she doesn't hold back at all.
That's for sure. One of the things I did want to ask you about was, I mean, again, I don't think this goes away too much, but there's a scene where she does some extremely emphatic swearing. So, like, yes. how do you like gear yourself up for that? Is that quite a kind of release?
The beauty of it is that I don't have to. That's all inside of me. it was one of my favorite things talking to director Bong. I was like, bloody hell, she swears a lot. And I was like, mind you, so do I. So I guess that's fine. That scene that you're talking about is one of my, you know, reading the script, I was like, oh God, yes, yes. It was funny because I actually had been wanting to play a character who got to be that emphatic for a really long time, just because there's so much going on in the world and I'm feeling so much and everyone's feeling so much. To be able to do that, to be able to do that in front of the people I was doing it in front of, was like, it was a special day.
That's amazing. I mean, it feels like, you know, with things like, you know, the Whitney Houston film, with things like Blink Twice, like you've been letting a lot of emotion out on screen. Yeah. Like you've got to process quite a bit recently.
Yeah. I keep on thinking, like, what would people, if your list of work was your personality, what would people think my personality was? I have no clue. I don't want to guess. But yeah, I'm just really attracted to that at the moment, or I was, because I mean, we filmed this 2 years ago now. Yeah, maybe one day I'll do something, you know.
Calm.
Quiet and calm, but it's not my personality.
But it feels like you've been working with incredible people. Director Bong, Cassie Lemons, Steve McQueen, like Asif Kapadia, like just incredible
Zoe
people.
Kravitz.
Yes.
I've just recently worked with an amazing director. I can't wait for people to see it. Ava Victor, who we made a film called Sorry Baby that she wrote, directed and was in. And I saw it for the first time at Sundance recently and was blown away. I've just been really fortunate to find people, creatives, who think the way I do and see in me something that can bring out their characters. And I just hope it continues. I'm really having a lot of fun, and I'm really proud of the projects I've been able to be a part of, how much it stretches me in different directions. And it's practice, right? And you just want to keep on practicing.
Yeah. And you've talked about wanting to maybe write and direct yourself in future.
Yeah,
are you kind of picking up do's and don'ts from these people?
Yeah, a lot of do's and don'ts. I think the biggest thing, now that I guess I can say I've got a taste for who I like to work with or how I like to work. And I guess the biggest thing is that regardless of what is happening, because so many things go wrong and you're running out of time and all of that, is like what it is to be a good leader is to be a great listener. And to be a galvanizer and to be a problem solver. And none of those things have to come with disrespect. None of those things have to come with a lack of clarity. They can be assertive without being unkind. I'm working towards directing myself one day. I can really see it for myself now. I mean, asked me 2 years ago, I was like, that would be a nice idea. And now I'm like, what do I want to do? What, when I'm given the opportunity, what do I want to make? And I've got some ideas.
Awesome.
Got some ideas. Yeah.
So tell me about directing, working with Bong Joon-ho.
I mean,
what a freaking legend.
Legend. I guess working with Bong Joon-ho, I had anticipated that I would feel like I was working in a church, if that makes sense. Like, because he's so prolific.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And actually what he was able to do was take it to a really human level. I never felt intimidated. I never felt like I couldn't come to him with a question or, maybe we try this. You know, it was just such an open space for everyone to put their two pence worth in. And he held the space really well. Like, you know, there's such structure around how he works from the storyboarding that actually when you go on set, by the time there's so much preparation that happens before that by the time you're there, you just get to play, which is a huge, huge privilege. You're just there going, shall we try it this way? Yeah, let's try it this way. Oh, okay. Oh, what do you think about that? Like, it was so much fun. And, you know, acting, when I started acting, it was just fun. And there were no stakes involved. And that's what it felt like on this job, that suddenly I forgot that we were making like a really big Warner Brothers movie with all these like movie stars attached and all of that. And it was just like, oh, we're just doing the fun thing again. And that was gorgeous.
That's amazing. I mean, I think you talked about Star Wars being like LARPing.
I'm sure I did.
So similar thing here then?
Yeah. Similar thing. I it's funny because that was when I was 26, and that was my first, you know,
big thing.
And I was so overwhelmed. I was overstimulated. I was like, I remember the first day I had like a panic attack on top of a hill because there were flying ants stuck in my afro, and I couldn't get the horse to go into the right spot, you know.
Not normal days problems.
Like
wow.
Yeah. But like I look at those experiences and go, wow, like that led me here to a space where I could be really present and really like confident in my ability and really be able to let go and just go for it. And, you know, I've watched it only once, so I get to watch it again tomorrow. I'm excited about that. And I'm just like, wow, that's come a long way now. Yeah. it's good. Yeah,
it's proper. I wanted to ask as well about working with Robert Pattinson, because your characters obviously have a very close relationship, but I was reading a bunch of your interviews ahead of doing this last night, and it felt like you've had, I think, a similar struggle with some of the kind of stardom aspects of your job as he has, like very maybe being uncomfortable sometimes with all of the kind of attention. Yeah. That felt like a very him thing. I mean, did you guys kind of, did that help you bond?
I did ask questions. I was curious because, like, you know, my level of attention is nothing in comparison to Rob's. And I was really curious. And, you know, I think the lessons stay the same. It's like you keep your circle of trusted people and you make sure that the people who are around you are grounded and see you for who you are. But for me, I still don't think I'm famous. I'm an actor. Like, I walk down the street, nobody knows who I am. The only weird thing that happened to me the other day was that a lady recognized me on the tube. I was like, ooh, look at that. Somebody knows my face from nowhere. That's cool. But the only time I ever like get into those situations is when I'm doing event stuff. And that's the way I keep on saying it, so maybe it's just like I feel like a broken record, but like I think it's a beautiful way to be because it allows you to disappear into the character, because it's not about me. It's really not. I love talking about work and I love talking about acting, but all the other stuff, promise you, really boring.
But then tell me about your on-screen relationship with him, because that
it was a
surprisingly romantic film. I didn't really see that coming.
Yeah, I mean, it's at the core of it, this is a love story, and like how your connections with people can put you into positions where you're helping other people. It was really fun. I was nervous because I don't really do a lot of romantic stuff. It's not really my field. It was daunting at times, but again, like Rob is such an incredible creative that I more or less immediately felt really comfortable to do what we needed to do. And I think we were all just so connected to the story and making sure that that relationship felt really clear and strong. You know, we would laugh because they're quite a, like, you wouldn't put them together. And so there were moments, like, especially with Nasha being how she is, just being like, wow, how did she, wow, okay. It's a really interesting relationship and it's so, like, refreshing. It's so different.
It's quite sweet. He's kind of in awe of her.
It's adorable, and like, and she is so loving of him. It's like this beautiful balance, you know. Is she in awe of him? I don't know. I think she sees the core of him, and what is special about their relationship is that she has loved him and makes a commitment to love him in all of his different phases. And there's something so romantic about that.
Yeah, it's very sweet. It's kind of a weirdly optimistic film in some ways.
I know, right?
It's
like weird. Yeah. It's weird, wacky sci-fi film. Like it's hopeful, even in its darkness, which I think like Bong is just a genius at. You know, that thing of being able to, two things can be true at the same time. Three, five things can be true at the same time. And his genre is of his own. So, yeah, I mean, gosh, I just feel so really, really, really fortunate to have been able to be a part of it and to be able to work with him.
Oh, man. So obviously, just to finish off, you've got the Thursday Night Murder Club coming up next. Now, obviously can't ask anything about whodunit or anything in that plot, but I do want to know one thing.
Don't read the book. Read the book.
Yeah. But who tells the most scandalous stories on set? Because I feel like group are...
Oh, God. I would say Helen. I would say Helen. And Celia. No, I would say Celia. I love them. Gosh, that job was just among the greats. And you're among people who are so comfortable in their ability. They work with just such a sense of joy. They're amazing. Yeah, so I learned a huge amount, and I'm really excited to see it. I haven't seen anything yet.
Fingers crossed. All right, well, thank you so much, and best of luck with Mickey 17.
Thanks, man. Cheers. Thank you.
Okay, that was Naomi Aki. We will be talking about Mickey 17 on next week's show. Right now, we're going to talk about the movies that are out this week. Not a lot to talk about this week, it must be said, but we must start with The Last Showgirl. Alex, you love this movie, you want to marry this movie, tell the good folks about this movie.
I want to at least be in a relationship with this movie. The Last Showgirl is set in Vegas, and it focuses on Pamela Anderson's character, Shelley, who is in her 50s, she's 57 to be precise, I think, and she's worked for a long time in this quite old-fashioned sort of sexy dance show. It's hard to really say what it is, but it's showgirls just strutting their stuff.
With the feathers and the diamonds.
With the feathers and the diamonds. The skimpy, glammy outfits. The show is closing, and this news is announced to them by the manager, who is Dave Bautista. There are a lot of brilliant bit parts in this film. Dave Bautista rocking quite a tremendous wig. And also sort of... he's quite understated, you know, compared to what we usually see him do. And it's basically about Shelley and this gang of girls, this family who've been working with her for, you know, various periods of time. And it's about how she emotionally and mentally deals with the fact that this show is closing. As this is sort of an end of an era, all of these, this is like the last show of its kind as the scene changes and makes way for more contemporary shows, more modern shows, more audacious, outlandish things. And they're a bit old-fashioned. There are like 8, 10, 12 people in the audiences for this show. And it's about... the show is coming to an end. She doesn't know anything else. She doesn't know what else she's got to give. And it's about what it means for her life, what it means for her career, her bank balance. And interweaved in all this is a bit of a family drama in terms of the sort of found family that she's created. And she's got a bit of a thing going with a sort of slightly estranged daughter played with Billy Lord. And then, I've mentioned Dave Bautista already. And just this brilliant assortment of women that she's working with. It's directed by Gia Coppola, who did a drama called Palo Alto, which I quite liked. 10 or so years ago, and then a film called Mainstream more recently, which I didn't see, an Andrew Garfield film. Like I said, Dave Bautista is in it. Jamie Lee Curtis is incredible in it, as sort of an older cocktail waitress who's like the matriarch of this family of girls. Jamie Lee Curtis is incredible in this film. There's a brilliant, brilliant and quite moving dance sequence she does to no one. You know, in her place of work, to Total Eclipse of the Heart. It's incredible. I actually think, I'll get on to Pamela in a minute, but Jamie Lee Curtis is so good in this film. And my theory is, were it not for Everything, Everywhere, All at Once winning her an Oscar a couple of years ago, I think she would have not been as overlooked as I believe she has been for Best Supporting Actresses, because she's brilliant in this film. But really, yes, it's all about Pamela Anderson. I don't want to repeat everything that I probably talked about in the interview, but it's a small film. It's quite a slight film. It's like a little character study of Shelley and all these other women and this situation. And it's, you know, it's a little thin. it's like a sketch, you know, it's like a moment really, but it's got so much heart and so much soul. And you can tell that everyone involved really feels strongly about the story and about the people it's exploring. And Pamela just gives it everything. And I think it's because she's not had the chance to do this before. And you really do, even though it's not based on her, you know, it was written, it was actually based on a play and adapted by the woman who written the film and wrote the play. It's not about Pamela Anderson, but you can feel her life and her some of her pain and it was some of her trauma, I would say, coming through in the role. She's a bit of an open wound on it. You can sort of see and feel everything she's feeling. And it's a little bit of a kooky performance, but I think it's because Pamela Anderson's quite a kooky person. Mm. And she just, I think she's absolutely fantastic in it. And you can just feel it. Just everything is so present on it. And I think it's a really touching piece of work.
Yeah. I think it's lovely. It's a fantastic performance again, but interestingly shot too. There are moments where it's almost out of focus.
It's very woozy. Yeah. It has a dreamlike quality to it.
Yeah, it does. And it sort of gives you an idea that she's been living in this slight haze for all this time. She's been living in Vegas and not really dealing with what are you going to do after this? Well, you know, this is one day going to come to an end. What's the plan at that point? And she's been kind of burying her head in the sand and is, you know, suddenly forced to deal with it. So I think it is a really... It's the kind of thing, again, it's the kind of character study that we've seen a lot about, you know, gangsters and things like that.
Yeah.
They've gotten into this job that, you know, kind of has a shelf life and now they don't know what to do next. We've seen it about hitmen, but, you know, this is about a showgirl. It's a kind of different side of life. Kiernan Shipka and Brenda Song as the sort of younger girls in the show who you get the sense have more options open to them. There's going to be more opportunities for them. But Shelley's at a point where she's not old enough to do nothing. She definitely doesn't have a huge retirement plan. But she's too old to do what she's always done. And that it's that kind of terror, I think. And it's very relatable. I think everybody has faced that in some aspect of their lives, if not in their work. I thought it was lovely. Again, I would say, yes, it is slight. It doesn't feel like it has a massive arc, a beginning, middle, and end. It's more of just a snapshot of a moment, but really beautifully done.
I agree. I think lots of people have talked about Pamela Anderson's performance, and it is outstanding. But, you know, you mentioned him, Alex, but Dave Bautista, I can't help remembering when he talked about when he was first cast as Drax, just the nerves of being a restaurant and trying acting for the first time and just genuinely feeling he wasn't going to be able to do it. And this role that he plays here is so subtle and underspoken and tender, and there's a real heart to it. It's a beautiful performance he puts on in this film. He's wonderfully cast in it.
Well, I can't imagine. I'm sure they were all paid peanuts, and I think they probably all did it because these roles gave them the opportunity to do things that these people haven't seen.
Right, absolutely.
Done before.
And I think they absolutely do that. And this film has a real melancholy to it. I mean, it absolutely bummed me out, but obviously that's what it's designed to, because it's someone looking back. She's a bit like Brooks in Shawshank. Like, she's institutionalized. She has been in this show for 38 years. She doesn't know anything else. Mm. And it's her reflecting on that, what she could possibly do next, and also coming to terms with the sacrifices she has made in order to have that life that she loved. And they are not small either. Mm. And there's a reckoning as part of this as well. So, yeah, it's not the most plotty film in the world, but it's beautifully done.
And like I say, it wasn't written for Pamela, but you can feel her coming through because we all know what happened to her over the years. We all know, you know, we've seen so much, you know, we've seen there's documentaries, blah, 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 blah. But there's a line in it where she suddenly finds some confidence and she's, I don't want to get too spoilery, but she's in a bit of a tense situation with someone who's not respecting her. And the character goes, and her age I don't think is mentioned in the film up to this point. She goes, I'm 57, motherfucker, and I'm beautiful. And I read that was improvised. Mm. That was Pamela saying that because she is 57. And that just came out in the moment. And there are a lot of moments, you do feel while you're watching it that she's got something to say and it's coming out through this dialogue and through this character. And I think that's beautiful to see that.
Motherfucker.
Yes, but we only gave it 3 stars, motherfuckers. Is that right?
It is right. We did.
It is what happened. I wouldn't say it's right necessarily. But
it is a fact that we gave it 3 stars.
It is a fact. Okay. Yes.
But clearly, none of you agree with that.
At least two of us, I think, in this room.
I'm somewhere between. I probably say the performances are absolutely knocking out the park. I think on the strength of the narrative of the film, you know, it's a high three. It is a high three, definitely.
A high three. Well, there we go. 3 stars in for The Last Showgirl. We've also given 3 stars, spoiler alert, to Fight or Flight, which is a movie that is debuting only on Sky Cinema and Now TV this weekend. It is on your Sofaplex. Do you agree with that, Helen O'Hara?
I do. Yes. Thank you
joining us on this week's.
Wow. So this comes to us from James Madigan. This is his feature debut.
Mm-hmm.
He has done, you know, second unit, first unit director kind of thing, stuff before, but not stepped up to the big chair. And I think this is actually quite a promising start. And I went in with very low expectations.
Yeah.
Like floor level or possibly sub-basement.
Just based on Josh Hartnett's hair, presumably.
Yes, hey. He is one of nature's brunettes. He should not be blonde. He is blonde in this film. He plays Lucas Reyes, who is a washed up, I'll just say agent. They reveal where he worked, but we didn't get into that. But he's stuck in Bangkok for reasons. And there is a shadowy organization led by Katie Sackhoff, my beloved Starbuck, who is not beloved in this one. She's not a very nice person, but she is trying to find a mysterious hacker-type person called the Ghost, who for some reason they know is going to be on this flight. Don't worry about it. And they send Reyes on board this plane because they have no one else in the area to try and find the Ghost and get the Ghost to them because the Ghost has valuable whatever. It doesn't matter. It's a MacGuffin. So Reyes is on the flight. Presumably somewhere on the flight is the Ghost. He has to find the Ghost and then keep the Ghost alive so the Ghost can be questioned and or exploited by Katie Sackhoff and company. Plot twist. The flight is also full of other assassins who really want to kill the Ghost. So if you thought, hey, I like Bullet Train, but I wish it was a plane, then do I have the film for you. It is exactly the same plot. It is nothing surprising happens, plot terms, right? Yeah. Nothing. And the dialogue is okay at best. It's fine. Everyone is playing stock characters. You know, nothing new there. What I think is good about this is actually the direction. I think James Madigan does a really good job of working with what he has. So he doesn't have Bullet Train's budget for incredible A-list stars and character actors, right? So what he's done is he's filled the plane with, I think, good stunt people.
Yeah.
And then he has really coordinated his camera movements with his fight choreographer and really made the most of everything the stunt people can do. So Josh Hartnett obviously has done a bit of training for this. He convinces as a guy who can punch his way out of many situations, but he doesn't have necessarily the balletic fluidity of a great martial artist. But it looks like he's holding his own throughout this. It looks convincing and it's fun. For the most part, there are some gnarly fights.
It's so violent. It is so over the top violent.
Cartoonishly,
unbelievably, gorily violent. But because of the tone, it's not going to shock you in that way. But there are moments of genius. There's a bit which I won't spoil with an overhead compartment, which is just a genius bit of choreography. It's not slickly choreographed as Bullet Train, John Wick, whatever you like. Like it's a little bit slapdash in the way that it's like I kind of when I saw this, this is like Bullet Train meets Smoke and Aces meets Midnight Run filtered through a Sky original. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's all of those things in one and it kind of embodies all of those aspects. But it is a lot more fun than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
And while I don't think all the gags land. Some of them definitely land. A lot of them don't. And it's very silly. There's a whole gag which could have been lifted out of a Jump Street movie about fighting while on drugs, which is utterly ridiculous. But it's quite a tight runtime and it's a good time.
It's fun. Yeah.
It is a fun film.
It's a good time. The words Sky Cinema original
I know
are usually terrifying and they have absolutely been trailing the shit out of this. I watch a lot of Sky Sports, as you might imagine, and pretty much every ad break on Sky Sports over the last 2 weeks has had a trailer for Fight or Flight. So they're getting behind it. And you know what? I was pleasantly surprised by it as well. And I think there's a great loss. We've lost a really nice chunk of Josh Hartnett's career where he wasn't Hollywood's go-to guy after having been Hollywood's go-to guy. And part of that is he withdrew. Part of it is Hollywood withdrew. There was miscommunication, but eventually they got it back on. And it's a bit of a shame because this is a movie that realizes that Josh Hartnett is a fucking unit. And it's not about necessarily what you were saying there about, convincing. He does convince in the fight scenes, but it's not about being balletic. It's like he is built like a brick shit house and he basically just beats the living crap out of all of these people in a really, really fun and entertaining way. And I thought the rest of the cast, we're not exactly dealing with as you say, movie stars or A-listers, and like where Bullet Train could afford to have a Sandra Bullock cameo at the end of it, for example. Their Sandra Bullock equivalent is Katie Sackhoff. No shade being thrown to Katie Sackhoff,
Never throw shade to Starbuck in
I would
holes,
never
right?
even dream of it. But there are some really, really lovely turns in this. It was co-written, interestingly enough, by DJ Catrona, who is an actor who was actually cast as Superman in George Miller's Justice League. And I wonder if he co-wrote it maybe with an eye to starring in it as Lucas, and then maybe they went with Josh Hartnett instead. But I was going to mention some people who are really, really great in it. Charitha Chandran is great as Isha, who is a stewardess with whom Hartnett forms a kind of alliance. Sanjeev Kohli, who's a great comedian, is very funny in a very brief role as the pilot who wants to be played by Tom Hanks in the inevitable movie. And they're just good people with good faces, memorable faces, and memorable fight moves. So it's a fun time.
We should also say it's co-written by Brooks McLaren, and I think that would have been a much better name for Josh Hartnett's character in the film.
So, well, that'll be for the sequel, that you know, which takes place during a Formula One race or something.
Brooks McLaren.
Brooks McLaren. Oh, my word. All right. 5 stars just for being co-written by Brooks McLaren, but 3 stars overall for Fight or Flight. And on that note, folks, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by, well, as you heard earlier on, director Bong.
Woo, woo.
Bong Joon-ho, director of Mickey 17, and of course the Oscar-winning Parasite, and the host, and a host indeed of other great movies, will be on this podcast talking to Helen O'Hara, and we'll also be joined by director Houston. That's right. Jack Houston, the actor Jack Houston, is making his directorial debut with a film called Day of the Fight, and he'll be on the show talking about that. It is very much a passion project for him. Of course, grandson of John Houston, so does directing run in the blood?
Let's find out.
I think it does. But anyway, we'll be talking to them on next week's show. But until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my 3 colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, Alex Godfrey.
Bye. I'm off to eat some bad dates.
Goodbye, James Dyer.
Goodbye, Chris. Insert obligatory plug for Pilot TV Podcast here.
Go on, hit me with it.
No, that was it.
Is that it?
Yeah, I'm doing it as a placeholder.
Have you ever had anyone from Taskmaster on her?
on the Pilot TV Podcast?
Yeah.
No, we don't cover shows like that, Chris.
No, entertaining shows that are good.
That's right.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. That's not the pilot way. Yeah. All right. Well, if you ever do, can I do that interview?
Yes. If little Alex Horn ever comes on the podcast, he's all yours.
I think little Alex Horn and I would be friends.
Really?
Yeah. We both support Liverpool Football Club. We both love golf. So I'm just saying, we could become friends. So you need to facilitate that.
Okay. Well, if I get the horn, I'll give you a call.
Oh, boy.
All right. It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
I'm off to watch Jonathan Bailey on stage and Richard II.
Jesus Christ, you don't stop. You're like an unstoppable Shakespeare machine.
That's
just
me.
Gobbling up Shakespeare left and right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's Richard II.
That's Richard II. Yeah.
Like Rocky II.
Not a lot like Rocky II. I think one of the history's things about Richard II is he wasn't enough like Rocky II. So
like Rocky II, like Rocky II.
Yeah. If he'd been more like Rocky II, things might have gone differently for him.
All right. Exciting stuff. All right. It's goodbye from Helen, and it's goodbye from me. I am off to think long and hard about who might make the greatest bottom. I'm going to Google perfect bottom and see if that will help me.
Yes.
Nothing will go wrong there.
Well, let's find out, shall we? Oh my God! I could be here sometime. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.